ABC News.
I knew that at that time he was the director of the Tidbinbilla Deep Space Tracking Station, which still exists just outside Canberra. I had a vague feeling that he had been the director of the Apollo Station, Honeysuckle Creek, specially built for the moon missions. But beyond that, I really didn't know very much.
And you were interested in his daughter at the time, I understand.
Oh, his daughter and I dated for 3 years. We were very serious. And then I did a few things that were not quite right. And one thing led to another, and it all ended. And it all ended pretty painfully for me. But I certainly deserve what I got. But nevertheless, I had great affection and respect for the family and for the girl I dated and for her dad. And many years later, in around the year 2000, I went to watch the film The Dish. And I sat there watching Sam Neill playing Cliff Buxton, the fictional character who's said to be the dish master, walking towards the park's dish. And knowing a little bit of Tom Reed's background, I sat there through the film thinking, where's any reference to Honeysuckle Creek? There was none, actually, that anybody would notice. It's just a very short reference right at the end, but blink and you'd miss it. And I just sat there watching this film thinking, wrong place, wrong person. And it really irritated me. And then a couple of years later, his wife, Margaret, who had been the president of the Senate and first female president of the Senate and a senator for the ACT, held a farewell party when she left the Senate for her Sydney supporters in the parliamentary dining room in Sydney. And Marg Reed, the girl who I dated, was there with her husband, and she and I sat together and we had a long chat. And I said, Marg, has your dad seen The Dish, the film The Dish? And she said, oh, no. He's heard that it contains some pretty significant factual errors and refuses to watch it. And so I said, well, he should watch it and correct them, you know, make sure they're corrected. And she said, oh, you know, Dad, he doesn't blow his own trumpet. He has a job to do. He does it. He considers things to be a team effort. And so there the matter rested for some more years. And then finally, after Tom Reed's death in 2010, I had another look at it and decided that I was going to have a crack at writing the story. Had Tom himself been alive, and if he was still alive today, he would have done everything in his power to stop me writing this book. That's the sort of guy he was. He never blew his own trumpet. He always credited other people with, you know, the good work that was done. And, you know, so it wasn't until he passed away that I was able to have a really good look at this story.
Yeah, in this book you've documented a remarkable rise of a man who was born in Glasgow, saw service in the Royal Navy towards the end of the Second World War, and found himself in Australia at Woomera.
Tom was born on the south side of Glasgow in 1927, which was a pretty tough place to be then and probably still is now. But his family, even though of relatively modest circumstances, were very close, and they could see that this young child was a very special person. At the age of three, when there was no electricity in his home, no electricity in his street, Tom asked his great-grandfather, where does electricity come from? And the family never forgotten this question. By the age of 10, he was telling his mother that one day, so this was in 1937, he was telling his mother that one day a man will land on the moon. And she said, oh, Tommy, your bum's hanging out the window and the rain's beating down on it. It's sort of Glaswegian for saying, cut the BS. He did very well at school, had some difficulties during the war because there were a lot of evacuations in Scotland and his education was mucked up quite significantly. His father backed him all the way, though, with the education authorities to try and get the best possible education available. And then he went into the Royal Navy at the age of 17. Cherry-picked, really, under a scheme whereby the very best and brightest people were trained up to use the sophisticated equipment that was then coming in onto the fleet, ordinary conscripts by that stage just couldn't get across stuff like radar and radio and so forth. So he did that, came back to Glasgow, went to the University of Glasgow, cleaned up, first class honours in electrical engineering, one of the brightest students I've ever had. And then wanting, I think, a change from post-war Glasgow, took a position with the Royal Australian Navy for 5 years, came to Australia, and when that was over, he was offered a position at Woomera in South Australia in about 1958, where the British were testing medium-range ballistic missiles, and his expertise quickly became how to track these missiles and how to figure out their flight paths, the heat, the temperature, the vibration, all that sort of stuff. And was in on the ground floor for that.
And crucially, this is where he, when he was at Woomera, came into contact with NASA officials. I mean, I'm thinking that's around about the 50s into the 60s, and where crucially around the 1960 mark, the space race had begun, and that's where his career in this area you're talking about literally took off.
The Americans were rather complacent about the technological lead that they thought they had over the Soviet Union during the 1950s. And so when the Russians launched Sputnik, which was the first artificial object to orbit the Earth, the Americans were quite put out. And in some quarters, I think it's fair to say, panicked by this. And this huge effort suddenly went into matching and bettering the Soviets in what rapidly became called the space race. And Woomera became a centrepiece for this because it happened to be located in a position that was important for determining whether or not an object launched from Cape Canaveral on the eastern seaboard of the United States got into orbit successfully or not. And so Tom was snaffled up very quickly to go and work on Project Mercury from Woomera. And Project Mercury was the first series of manned space missions. And he came to NASA's notice and performed exceptionally well for them.
And of course, then, as a result of his performance at Woomera, he finds himself towards the end of the 60s, probably the mid part of the 60s, to add Honeysuckle Creek, not initially, but eventually to Honeysuckle Creek, where he played a pivotal role in the man landing on the moon.
Honeysuckle Creek was specially built by NASA as one of three Apollo tracking stations to track manned moon missions. The Americans decided that they had to keep contact with astronauts on and around the moon 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. The only exception to that was when the astronauts were in orbit on the far side of the moon when they couldn't be contacted at all. Now, because the Earth spins on its axis once every 24 hours, three Apollo space tracking stations were needed, spaced equidistantly around the globe so they could swap the signal as between them and keep it constantly with the moon. Honeysuckle Creek outside Canberra was one such station. A place called Fresnadales, which is outside Madrid in Spain, was another. And Goldstone, which is near Barstow in the Californian desert, was the third. And they were built specifically for Apollo. Now, the one at Madrid and the one at California were manned in all senior and important positions by Americans. It was Australian government policy that no Americans would be employed at Honeysuckle, something NASA accepted. The first director of the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station, bright fellow, personable fellow, but didn't have the special qualities needed to be a space tracker and to superintend other trackers. And the place was a mess, so much so that NASA became quite concerned that this alone might stop the Americans meeting President Kennedy's promise, which was to put a man on the moon and return him safely to Earth by the end of 1969. These tracking stations were so important that if they weren't all in a state of green light readiness, there would be no Apollo launch. They were as important as the rocket itself. And so this first director, who just could not do the job, was moved on to another position, and Tom Reed was brought in to sort things out. And he did so. He was quite ruthless. He put the cleaners through a whole bunch of engineers, got them all moved on. and brought in technicians in many cases to do the jobs they'd done, knowing from his time in the Navy that a good technician was often better than an engineer. And within the space of about 3 months, I think it was, Honeysuckle Creek had gone from being the worst station in the network to the best station in the network.
Let's bring you to July of 1969, when the manned landing for Apollo 11 was due to begin. Now, one of the most fascinating revelations, to me at least, Andrew, in the book, is the fact that NASA originally didn't want to televise the moon landing. That's remarkable, but in the end they did. And the planets, so to speak, were aligned in such a way that it came into the purview of Honeysuckle Creek to be the dish that televised the moon landing to the world.
The basic reason for the existence of the Apollo tracking stations was to transmit voice from Houston up to the astronauts, transmit voice from the astronauts back to Houston, transmit a ranging code up to the astronauts to know where they were at any time, and the ranging code coming back down, to provide for automatic commands to be given to the spacecraft, and to provide for telemetry. That's to say, data about the astronauts' heart rates, about their respiration rates, about the fuel levels in the lunar module, all that sort of stuff. Television was not central to the mission. It was an add-on. It was a luxury in many ways. And so at NASA, there'd been a raging debate going on for 10 years about whether or not there would be any attempt to televise the first moon landing. There are a whole bunch of people who said it's a luxury, it's superfluous. We're extremely weight sensitive and space sensitive in the lunar module. There's no room for a TV camera, let alone a remotely operating TV camera. Other people said, well, American taxpayers are paying for this. They're paying literally hundreds of billions of dollars. If we can, they deserve to see this show on their TV sets. That debate went on for about 10 years. The way NASA handled it was to say, all right, we will develop a special lightweight TV camera just in case. TV cameras in those days, I think, weighed about 400 pounds or something. This thing weighed 6 pounds. It was light sensitive. It was temperature sensitive to the moon, dust, all that sort of stuff. It was a little miracle. And about 3 or 4 weeks before Apollo 11 blasted off, the decision was finally taken. Okay, we're going to attempt to televise this, and we're going to attempt to televise Armstrong stepping onto the moon, which means this camera's got to operate remotely. And so that's the setup, but only a few weeks before blast off in July 1969.
And finally, Andrew Tink, who would have thought all of us have their stories of where we were when we saw the moon landing? You were at home in Sydney. But I suppose you would never have thought at that time that you would have this link with the man who was pulling the lever, so to speak, at Honeysuckle Creek.
I guess I wouldn't have thought that, but it's kind of nice. And at this time in my life, actually, I find one of the most pleasurable things is closing circles with friends and contacts from long ago. And this has been, you know, a most wonderful exercise with, I hope, a worthwhile outcome.
ABC News.